Herman Goering had made a statement. The American Air Force will never get to Berlin. So on the 6th of March of 1944, we got there in force.
Richard Bouchong was at the controls of a B-17 Flying Fortress over Berlin on that day 80 years ago. It was the first full daylight bombing raid on the German capital. The U.S. aerial armada of bombers and fighters stretched out in the sky for 94 miles. They brought significant damage to the Nazi war machine, both real and psychological. But American losses were also heavy. Richard flew with the 390th Bomb Group, part of the 8th Air Force, now best known by their moniker, Masters of the Air. Their incredible courage came at a great cost. Of all the men making up the bomber crews, nearly 60% were killed, wounded, or taken prisoner. Richard Bouchong was among the fortunate ones. He survived 28 missions over Nazi-occupied Europe. After the war, Colonel Bouchong spent over three decades in the Air Force, and for the last 30 years, he has served as a docent for the 390th Memorial Museum in Tucson, Arizona. We sat down for a conversation as a museum crowd gathered to hear his story. It's the story of a man who has known luck and long life, and he's lived it with a sense of humor.
2 weeks from today is my birthday, and I will be 101 years old. And I want to tell you what keeps me young. I have a younger girlfriend. She's 96. And we're going to get married in 2025. And I'd like to invite all of you to the wedding. And so you will know where to buy the wedding presents. The bridal registry is at Walgreens drugstore.
You were born and raised in St. Mary's, Ohio, which is not too far from Wright Field. Is that what inspired you to fly?
Maybe. I was always enthusiastic about airplanes, and my dad treated me to a ride in a two-seater open cockpit, and then later in a tri-motor, Ford tri-motor, I got to ride in one of those. I was so enthusiastic about airplanes. I built a lot of models, flew them. Rubber band was the engine in those days. Wound up the rubber band, and away she went. I flew all kind of models, and then I went to work at Wright Field. And while I was there on nice days, I would go down on the flight line for my lunch. I'd sit down there on a concrete bunker and have my lunch watching the airplanes come and go. I just loved airplanes and wanted to fly so bad.
And you wanted to be a cadet?
Yes.
In the Army or Air Corps?
Yeah.
And so you had to take a test,
yeah,
which was not an easy test.
No, it was not. 24 took it the day I did, and only 4 passed.
And you were one of the 4.
I was. And they said, come back tomorrow for your physical. Well, I passed that. And they said, okay, we'll call you. So it was a while, a couple of weeks before they called me and said, come over and get sworn in. So I did. And the guy said, now you're a private in the Army. Oh. I said, whoa, wait a minute. I didn't want to be a private in the Army. I wanted to be in the Air Force. He said, that's just until we get an opening into cadets.
You were certain that that was not going to be a situation where you would all of a sudden find yourself in the infantry.
I wasn't. I was afraid that's what was going to happen. He said, you're now a private in the Army. Wow. Well, the Air Force was in the Army at that time.
So you were part of the 390th Bomb Group, and you went to Washington State for training.
Yes. And at that time, I was not a part of the 390th.
Okay, that came later.
Yeah. So we went up there, and whole bunch of different skill levels of kinds arrived up there, radio operators, gunners, pilots, co-pilots, and navigators, bombardiers, and they formed the 10-man crews, and we trained together up there in Washington for probably a couple of months. I'm not sure of the time. And then we shipped overseas.
You wanted to be a pilot, of course.
Yes, I did.
And you were you're a tall guy, 6 foot. So you didn't wind up in a fighter because the little guys went to the fighters.
Yeah, that's right. It was a little tight in the fighters. I did fly 3 World War II fighters in test pilot school, but it was a little tight in there.
So you're off to Framlingham, England in November of 43.
Yeah.
You land there, and you're with your crew, the crew that you trained with.
Yeah.
And you're about to go out on a mission, and you take ill.
Well, we had flown a couple of practice missions around England to learn how the formation worked in over there and how to find home. That was one of the first things, how to find your home base. Well, I got sick one night. It was after normal duty hours. I was started up chucking. And I thought, oh, boy, I better go tell the flight surgeon what's happening, because he'll want to ground me with this. He won't let me fly. So I went into his office. He was still there. He did some tests. And he said, I think you have yellow jaundice, so I'm going to send you to the hospital. You're staying here tonight. He had a bunk in his office there for me. Next day, ambulance to the hospital about 35 miles away. He put me in a ward with a whole bunch of yellow guys. And I didn't turn yellow. And they kept me there a couple of weeks. They kept checking me and checking. And finally, the doctor says, you don't have hepatitis or the yellow jaundice. And whatever you had wrong with you is over, so you're going back to duty. Okay.
So they released you from the hospital. And as I understand it, you had to hitchhike to get back to the base.
I did. There was no normal transportation. So I got a ride in an ambulance down about halfway, and then I got out there and got a truck that was going my direction. They dropped me at Framlingham. So, oh boy.
When you get back to camp, you go to your hut. And what do you see when you get to your hut?
It was after dark, and it was Christmas Eve. And I got to my hut, opened the door, and turned the light on. The switch was right beside the door. In there were 12 beds. There had been 12 guys in there. That's the officers of 3 different crews. Each crew had 4 officers, 2 pilots, navigator, and bombardier. So we had all come in together. I had turned the light on. There were 12 beds, but 11 of the mattresses were rolled up with no bedding on. And mine was over in the corner, and the bed was still made, and my clothes were still hanging. So I went across the street to the orderly room of our squad. It was after normal duty hours, and there was a guy on duty called CQ, Charge of Corps. And I told him my name, and I said, where'd you move my crew? They were right there in that hut. Oh, I don't know. But next door is the operations officer for our squadron, and he knows where everybody is. So go in and ask him. So I did. I went into that hut next door, and the operations officer was Major Pennebaker. And I told him my name, and he said, oh, your crew was shot down. All 3 of those crews were shot down while I was gone. Two and a half weeks or thereabouts. Holy mackerel. Oh, that was, what a shock. He saw the shock, and he went over to a Foot Locker, got a bottle of bourbon and tin cup and poured a little bit, said, you better have this. Then he said, I don't want you to go back over to that hut tonight. You spend the night here. I got an extra bunk. Boy, I didn't want to go back over to that hut with this, all those empty bunks.
These are guys you know. These are guys you trained with.
Yeah.
And they're gone.
They're gone. My crew and those two others, I knew all of them. Oh, boy.
You knew the dangers and the risks of your job over there, but right away you get smacked upside the head.
Oh, boy. Two of those crews were shot down on their first mission. The other one was the first or second. I have not been able to find it. Can you imagine that? I was gone a couple of weeks and come back and they're gone.
Did any of them survive?
Yes, they did, but we did not know that for about 2 months. Finally, through the Red Cross, we received information that they were all prisoners of war. All 10 got out of the airplane, and all 10 were captured, and they were all prisoners of war. Now, that was in December of 1943. So they were in prison until the middle of 1945.
Do you remember after that your first mission?
Yes, I do. My first mission was on the 30th of December of 1943. I had been assigned a new crew right away when I got back. And that mission was to bomb a chemical factory at Ludwigshafen, Germany. So we bombed that factory that day. So that was my first experience. I saw it all, the flak and the fighters, and I had wanted to see it, but I didn't. It wasn't fun. I was scared about half the time at the mission.
Was it what you expected?
Yes, it was. I knew what to expect, but to see it was quite shocking. And I never ever got back without holes in my airplane. Always got hit.
When you fly into a flak field, what's that like? What are you looking at? What are you saying to your pilot?
Well, here we go. All targets were heavily defended. They had flak all the way around each target. So when we get there, we get to a point, it's called the IP, target's here. The IP is here. And that, our group makes a turn, and now we're on the bomb run into the target in heavy flak. There's no way of avoiding it. It was there. So we're all taking hits as we proceed to the target. Now, as we get out of there, on the other side, there's heavy flak also, because they didn't know which way we were going to approach that target. So they put flak all the way around it, heavy anti-aircraft installations. That was really bad news. We were taking hits, all of us. It depended how accurate the flak was. Sometimes a lot of the bursts were in our formation. Sometimes a lot of them were outside and up above. Now, if it burst up above us, it just ahead of us, if that shell exploded, it sent pieces of shrapnel in all directions. They're falling, and we ran into those pieces. That was very dangerous. It was pieces of steel that were hitting with our airplane.
And you had occasion to have that happen then, right?
Yes. Oh, my golly. We ran into a lot of that stuff. It was falling, but if it exploded close to you, you got the shrapnel right off of the explosion. The burst of the anti-aircraft was loud enough that if it was close, you could hear it in the airplane. If it was close to the airplane, you could feel the shock when the thing went off, and you knew that there were pieces of steel hit your airplane then. I never, ever got back without holes in my airplane. Sometimes just a few, 20 or 30 holes, but sometimes a lot, 120 or 30. Oh, my golly. Had a lot of holes.
One of the things that strikes me about the B-17, which you think is a remarkable aircraft, and it demonstrated that it certainly was, but it's a thin skin.
Yes.
So everyone who's under the impression that you are protected by aluminum, that doesn't happen. It's really thin. It's 25,000?
Oh, sure. You could shoot a 22 rifle, and it would go through both sides. It'd go in one and out the other. There was nothing to stop it. Aluminum skin. It went right through. So it hit what was on the other side. Now, I flew 28 missions over Germany, and I never got hit in my body. I flew several wars, and I never got hit in any one of those wars.
How about members of your crew? Did any of them get hit?
Yes. I had four men injured on my crew. Four men. One, the most serious one, was my tail gunner. When he was firing his guns, he was on his knees and hanging onto the back end of that gun. He got hit in the knee. A serious hit. It hit his knee and took a bunch of the flesh, peeled it back. Well, he screamed bloody murder back there, and the two waist gunners went back and drug him out of there and patched him up. They laid him up in the waist on the floor there and put his flesh back together. They didn't sew it or anything, just laid it over there and then put medicine on it and gave him a shot. When we got down, the ambulance met our airplane and picked him up and took him to the hospital. But what they did, they didn't have penicillin yet. They put sulfa powder in that wound and sewed it back up. Well, that's the best they had at that time, sulfa. About 3 weeks later, this boy came limping into my hut at night, and he said, "Sir, I talked to the flight surgeon, and he said I can fly again, but I can't get back in that tail gun compartment. Can I fly as your waist gunner?" He wanted to go. He wanted to go get shot at and do what we had to do. That was a wonderful experience. And I said, "You sure can." So he flew, still crippled a little bit, but he flew. Combat mission. Tough kid.
When you're flying in formation at altitude before you begin a bomb run, it's cold up there.
Oh, yeah.
How cold?
I had a gauge in the cockpit that read outside air temperature. And during our bombing altitude, I saw temperatures between 30 and 50 below zero. Now, 40 below was pretty common, but I saw 50 below on two of them. We were a little higher, and it was cold on the ground. My flights were winter and early spring over Germany. Germany's cold in the winter and early spring. Every 1,000 feet was 2 degrees less centigrade. That's the lapse rate, 2 degrees centigrade for 1,000 foot. So if we're 23,000 feet, that's a lot of change between the ground and where we were. That's the standard lapse, 30 to 50 below zero. The higher we flew, the less accurate the flak was. So that's why we flew our bombing missions up between 19 and 24,000 feet, because the flak was less accurate the higher we got. So let's make it less accurate. That was the only way we could do that, was to fly high. But by the same token, that made our bombing less accurate. The bomb sight was exceptionally good at 5,000 feet or below. The bombardier in practice could put that practice bomb on that target time after time at 5,000 feet. At 22,000 feet, here's what happened. The bomb sight crosshairs were on the target of the lead airplane. All of us dropped when the lead airplane dropped. So here's lead squadron, low squadron, high squadron. The bombardier in that lead airplane was the only one looking through his bomb sight when we're on the bomb run. All other bombardiers on that bomb run were watching that lead airplane very closely. And when he opened his bomb bay doors, every bombardier opened the bomb bay doors. And then they watched very carefully. When the nose of that first bomb came out of his bomb bay, every bombardier hit his release switches, and our bombs began coming out. So we all, 21 to 30 of us, bombed at the same time. So it was all done like that. But now we're 22, 23,000 feet. The bomb sight had the crosshairs on the target. The bombs drop, and they're dumb bombs. They're not guidable. Going down, there are winds that are different from where we were. The bomb sight made a correction for what the winds at our altitude were. But the bombs drifting down would be affected by winds between us and the ground. The first group to bomb a target was going to miss, almost certainly. Even though that bombardier had his crosshairs on the target, the bombs were going to drift one direction or another and miss the target. But here's what happened. The next group to bomb that was watching where their bombs hit. So he corrected for it, and if they hit left of the target, he aimed to the right, and his went drift right onto the target. So it was a matter of correction to get those bombs right on the target. But boy, we obliterated a lot of targets. We bombed a lot of industrial targets, factories that were making war materials were what we were after, and slow down the war effort. Boy, we put tons and tons of bombs on them, though, to get them done.
In early March 1944, the 3rd and 4th of March, you get a briefing. You're part of the briefing.
Yep.
And they draw back the curtain, and they say, target Berlin.
Yes.
You're going after the capital of the German
Empire. Well, we're not going to bomb the city, although they say Berlin. There are specific targets on the edge of the city that we were to bomb. Our group was briefed the 3rd and the 4th, and we started on it. We actually got up in the air and got over Germany. One time we were recalled, one of those, and the other one, because of weather, we turned around and went back. So now the Germans knew where we were going to go. They knew we were headed to Berlin. Guess what they did? They moved all of their fighters up into the area we had to go through to get to Berlin. So on the 6th of March, which was actually the first full daylight raid on Berlin, first full raid ever, they had all their fighters up into the area we had to go through. They estimated that our formation was attacked by 600 enemy fighters on our way in and on our way out. Now, our formation was 94 miles long, so there were fighters hitting various parts of it. But I saw a bunch of them that day. Now, we had P-51s by then, but not as many as there were Germans. We lost 69 heavy bombers over Germany. 69 went down over Germany that day. Each one had 10 people on board. The Germans, we shot down 92 German fighters. That was their total loss for the day. And we lost 11 of our fighters. So that's the tally for the day. 69 went down over Germany. I don't know how many got back that never flew again. One of ours did. One of our ships made it back to England, landed, crash-landed on the base, and was so badly damaged that it was not repairable. So it was a total loss. But that didn't count in the 69. 69, we lost over Germany. Boy, terrible day. And I was on that mission.
What was it like in your aircraft?
We were all scared because we knew where we were going. And we knew what was going to happen. They're going to send up a lot of fighters. And we saw a bunch of them, not 600, but I felt like we saw half of them. Oh, my golly, they were thick in the air. But they were after us at times. But they respected the 390th formation. We flew a very snug, proper position formation, which was a great defensive firepower, the way it was designed. Other groups did not fly a good snug formation. Let me give you an example. That day, we put up 30 airplanes, 10 in the lead squadron, 10 in the low squadron, and 10 in the high squadron. The 100th group was in our wing. The wing consisted of three groups, the 95th, the 100th, and the 390th. So we always went to the same target, the same route, all three of those groups. So that day, we put up 30 and lost one. The 100th group went to the same target, same route that we did. They put up 30 and lost 15. Now, I attribute part of that loss to lousy formation flying. So they were all over the sky, and fighters would take a look at us and say, and they'd go hit them. So that day, they lost 15 out of 30. We lost 1 out of 30. We went the same place. So that's a very good example of good formation flying, I think. The formation was a very strong defensive formation. Everybody could shoot in any direction without having another airplane directly in his line of sight. We bombed targets all around the edge of Berlin. Our targets were industrial targets. They were factories located around the edge of Berlin. So our target on that first day, the 6th of March, was an electrical equipment manufacturing company right on the edge of Berlin. We saw pictures of it in our briefing. They told us there's where it was, and we knew exactly what it looked like. So we bombed that target on the 6th of March. About 25 years ago, I said, I wonder what the name of that company was. I had never heard. So I got out a stack of books. And I went through book after book, and I found it. The target we bombed that day was Bosch, Bosch factory. They're still making stuff, and it's good stuff. But I can guarantee you they're not making it in that factory. When we got done with it, it was rubble.
You had 25 missions that you were to fly when you were over there, but then they changed that to 30, and because of your number was prorated, so you did 28.
I did 28.
On the 28th mission, you're flying the Belle of the Brawl.
Yeah.
And your mission is to bomb a factory in Augsburg, Germany, which is near
Munich. Yeah,
the
factory was a Messerschmitt factory, or an aircraft factory.
What happened that day?
Okay, that day, our formation was 21 airplanes. So we took off and we're going to Augsburg, Germany. England's up here. Augsburg is way down in southeast Germany. So it's a long haul down there. We're going to be seven and a half hours down there and back. The route to fly was not always a straight line from here to there. They avoided major flak installations on our way to and from the target, all 21 of us. We were taking a lot of flak on the way into that target. We got to the target, and all of us were able to drop on the target, the aircraft factory that we were bombing. And three of our airplanes, out of our group went down right there over the target. So when we turned away from there, there were only 18 of us left, all of us with some damage. As we left there, and now when we left the target, we had to get out of there. There was flak on our exit also, heavy flak, because they didn't know which way we were going to come into that target, so they had it all the way around. My little ball turret gunner called in, "We got oil running out of number one engine. It's running back over the wing." He's the only one that could see the bottom of the airplane. So it was running on the back of the wing. I said, "Well, how fast is it running?" He said, "It's a steady stream, but it's not a gusher." Very important word, not a gusher. So I said, "Okay." And I kept it running. Now, we had oil pressure gauges for each engine in the cockpit, so we could watch that. But I kept that engine running, and it allowed me to stay in formation. We proceeded back toward home. As we neared the border of Belgium, we were probably 100, 150 miles from the border of Belgium, which was also enemy territory. But as we neared that border, there was a big cloud bank ahead of us that was higher than we were. You cannot take a formation into a cloud bank or you begin banging into each other and losing airplanes. So we diverted around that big cloud bank. The diversion took us right over a German airfield. Not a good place to be. The flak was extremely accurate, and a lot of it. Every burst was going off right in our formation. And so we were all taking hits. As we left there, my little ball turret gunner said, he called in, "We got oil gushing out of number two and number three engine." Oh, boy, that meant I had a real serious hit in the oil system of those two engines. Each engine had its own private oil system. I had a co-pilot that I'd never flown with, and I didn't know what his capability was. So I got the top turret gunner out of the top turret. He was my flight engineer, and I'd flown a lot of missions with him and knew him and trusted him. I said, "You stand right here." There was room between the pilot's seat and the co-pilot for him to stand. So he stood right beside me. I said, "You watch those oil gauges. We have three engines leaking oil. Two of them are gushing. If you see any oil pressure dropping, you have my permission to hit the feather button without any question. Do it right now." Feather button. There were four of them on the instrument panel. And when you hit that button, it started a pump in the very bottom of the engine oil tank and pumped oil at high pressure to the shiny part of the prop dome, and made the prop blades go to the feathered position. It was called the feather button. Okay, he's standing there watching those gauges, and all of a sudden an arm came over my shoulder and hit number two feather button, and the prop feathered, and I shut the engine down. I neglected to mention that number two engine manifold had furnished a little warm air that was pumped into the cockpit by a blower to defrost our windshield. When I shut that engine down, the warm air stopped, the windshield, every window in the cockpit frosted up right away. It was 40 below zero outside. I had to back out of the formation. I couldn't see to fly formation with other airplanes, so I had to get out of there so I didn't run into somebody. So now I'm a crippled airplane in enemy territory all by myself. And in about 4 or 5 more minutes, an arm over my shoulder and hit number three feather button. And it was too late. We had lost too much engine oil. There was not enough left to feather the prop. The pistons were going in and out without oil. You can imagine what happened. And that engine was red hot and it stopped. It ceased from friction, from lack of oil. The prop was out here no longer connected to the engine. It's still spinning. To me, it's drag, a lot of drag. I had to push it through the air. So here we are in enemy territory, number one has been leaking oil all the way from the target and still running. Number two is feathered and shut down. And number three, the engine is shut down, but the prop is windmilling. And number four was a good engine. Thank God for one. If number one, which has been leaking all the way from the target, and we're now about 3 hours away from the target, if it quit, we had to get out of the airplane because one outboard engine, you can't fly with one outboard engine. You put power on it and the airplane wants to fly sideways, so that wouldn't work. So I had everybody ready to get out if we're over land, and we're all scared and we're all praying a lot as we headed toward home. Anyhow, and I got back near our base. And what was happening was there was the guys that beat me home were circling to get in. Our procedure was, if you had wounded on board, you shot a red flare. If you had mechanical difficulties, you shot a green flare. We didn't talk to the tower because the Germans were listening to all of our frequencies. So that was our signal. We needed an ambulance or we had mechanical difficulties. Maybe a fire truck should be watching it. It looked like they were having a Christmas celebration. Everybody was shooting red and green flares all over the place. I finally got into the pattern at home. I got down into the pattern and most of them had landed. I had to make one complete circle before I could get on the final approach. Now I'm only on two engines and one windmilling. So I got on the final approach to the airfield. 6,300 feet was our runway length, and that's pretty skimpy for an airplane this size. I got it on the final approach, and because of my condition, I was afraid that the airplane might start to settle and land short of the field. So I carried a little extra speed down the final to keep that from happening. I deliberately carried an extra 10 miles an hour down the final. I landed, got the airplane on the runway, but it was a little farther down than my normal landing and going a little bit faster. I hit the brakes. There were none. No brakes. I'm going 80 miles an hour. There's about a mile left of the runway. I'm slowing down a little bit because of gravity, but not enough. I'm still going to be going 50 miles an hour when I got to the end of the runway. Runway ended, and there's a taxi strip. And across the taxi strip, there was a little bit of a slope. And there was our boneyard for our base. That's where they took the wrecks to salvage parts off of them to fix other airplanes. I got about 600 or 700 feet from the end of the runway, still going pretty fast. And I forced the airplane to ground loop. Now, ground loop means sharp turn. I put full power on number one engine and made the airplane turn sharply to the right. So here I am on the runway, full power on number one, turn to the right. Now I'm off the runway. That was what I wanted to do, get it out there in the good old English mud. Thank God for English mud. It was nice and gooey and soft out there. I pulled, after I got it off and straightened out, I pulled all the power off, and it went about 150 yards out in the mud, and then it just went, ugh. The main gear were buried about that deep, those big old tires, and there was a pile of mud ahead of each one of them where we slid out through that mud. Oh, my golly. The 10 of us got out. Now, one man was wounded, but we had him all patched up. He got hit in the jaw with a piece of flak. His buddy pulled that piece of flak out and put some medicine on it, and Band-Aid, so he was okay. The 10 of us were standing out in front looking at this wreck and just being so thankful that we had made it back to England, that we weren't in Germany somewhere. It was pretty close. The crew chiefs were always watching when the group came back to see if their airplane is one of the ones that made it back. So that day, three of ours did not make it back. But the crew chief for this one, called Bell of the Brawl, was watching, and he saw his airplane land, and it didn't look very good. It was full of holes, covered with oil, and one engine was, the prop was feathered, and one was flopping around out here. And then he watched it go down the runway, and he saw me put it in the mud. He got on his bike and rode as far as he could, and then he slogged through the mud out there to where we were. We're all still standing there, being so thankful we had made it back to England, that we weren't in Germany. He had an entirely different attitude. He had to fix it. He got out there and he stood there looking at his airplane, and it was a mess, full of holes, two engines out. He turned to me and said, "Gee, Lieutenant, what'd you do to my airplane?" I said, "No, let's get that part straight. I didn't do any of that. The Germans did that. They shot that airplane up." Well, here's the history. 25 days later, he had that airplane all fixed, and it flew a mission and was shot down, and 8 were killed and 2 were taken prisoner. That was the next mission on the airplane. Oh, my golly. How lucky can you get? That was my 28th and my last mission. I'm done. I had to fly no more combat. I was there for another couple months, and I flew as instructor pilot for new crews and test flights and whatever they needed doing, but no more combat. That was my last mission, and boy, was I glad it was over. Whew. It's everyone.
I've heard you say several times today that you didn't know when to quit. And that is apparently true, because you came home from World War II and you continued to serve in the Air Force. You did 32 years.
Yeah. At the end of World War II, I got out and I stayed in reserve. And they finally got organized, so I had a base to go to and fly. So I flew B-50s and B-29s at a base near my home. And then I got recalled for Korea. From then on, I was active duty.
But you're a test pilot.
Yeah.
And you served also in Vietnam. You flew F-4s
yeah.
in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Well, you flew how many different types of aircraft in your career?
43 different types.
And the range of speed goes from...
0 in a helicopter to Mach 2.1 in an F-4. Now, that was on a test flight. And we had to go supersonic on every test flight, but didn't have to go that fast. I just pushed it a couple of times.
When you look back, and we're reminded now with the airing of Masters of the Air, when you look back on everything that you did and all your fellow pilots, navigators, bombardiers did over Europe, you really saved us from tyranny.
Oh, yeah.
And I know you realize that. You think about that a lot?
I did then. I knew what was happening in Germany, and I thought, we have to do this to prevent that, to stop it. It was terrible what was going on in Germany. So what we were doing was trying to stop it, and we did. We were very instrumental towards stopping it.
And like the young crew member who, even though he's wounded, he says, "Lieutenant Bouchon, I gotta serve. I gotta make another mission."
He right? wanted to go. Yeah.
Yeah.
This young lad. Yeah, he wanted to go. He yeah. wanted to go. Do what we had to do. I did too. I thought it was necessary that I do that. I was scared every time, but I went. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was important, I thought.
Well, thanks for saving us from tyranny. And congratulations on 100 years and almost 101.
Thank
Pretty
you.
Spectacular.
Thank you. Well, thank you. It
thank
was a
you.
Real pleasure.
Real pleasure here, Colonel.
Thank you.
Real pleasure. Thanks.
couple of footnotes that underscore the good fortune of Colonel Bouchong. During his time with the 390th, he flew seven different B-17s on combat missions as pilot or co-pilot. Six of those seven aircraft were shot down or crashed when other pilots were in the cockpit. 32 men died during those missions, and 18 were taken prisoner. That's not lost on Richard Bouchong, who never fails to mention to his museum audiences, "I am a very, very lucky man." We hope you found today's Honor, Thank, Inspire episode to be moving and meaningful. If you did, please consider sharing this podcast and make sure you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The impact Honor Flight Chicago has on the lives of our veterans and their families is made possible by the generosity of our donors. To support our mission, to find our veteran application, to volunteer, or simply for more information, please visit us at honorflightchicago.org.